Today on Future Tense, the Stanford University academic who believes Hong Kong could hold the key to lifting developing countries out of poverty, technology as a tool of foreign policy, and turning our backs on innovation. Hello, Anthony Fennell here, and welcome. Now, cast your mind back 12 years.
This is Sky News with Bob Friend, live from Hong Kong.
Hello again from Hong Kong. On the night, the colony is about to be handed back to China. At last, the moment has arrived. After 156 years of British rule, China takes over the vibrant and enormously successful island of Hong Kong and the new territories. Time has run out. On the stroke of midnight, just 1 hour from now, Britain loses one of its proudest possessions. For once, not a case of Britain granting a former colony independence. This time, China, the world's largest communist country, will be in charge of a staunchly capitalist community.
A major reason Hong Kong was such a proud possession for the Brits was because it was one of the showpiece economic success stories of the 20th century. And it was the economic value of Hong Kong, as well, of course, as national pride, which drove the Chinese to pursue its return. Hong Kong has long been a subject of fascination for many in the West, and for Stanford University's senior fellow, Paul Romer, it's at the very heart of his new concept, called Charter Cities. So what I hear you ask is a charter city.
All it takes to grow a charter city is an unoccupied piece of land and a charter. The human, material and financial resources needed to build a new city will follow, attracted by the chance to work together under the good rules that the charter specifies. Action by one or more existing governments can provide the essentials. One government provides land, and one or more governments grant the charter and stand ready to enforce it.
So just as the British built Hong Kong from a series of fishing villages, Paul Romer believes Western nations in the 21st century could help build Hong Kong-style cities in the developing world. At least that's the theory. And on his website, he gives several examples. Canada, for instance, building a neo-Hong Kong in Cuba, or Indonesians flocking to a manufacturing hub in Australia. Paul Romer.
The essence of this idea is to take some place where people currently don't live, to specify a charter, to say, this is how this place will be governed, and then to give people the option to opt in to that charter. Now, in the context of a developing country, the charter and its enforcement might be jointly agreed to by the developing country and some partners. But in other situations, you could have this same structure of a choice to move into a place with a pre-specified charter. And it's that idea which I think is really very powerful as a way to start to think about how can we improve the quality of governance? How can we create new places with new kinds of rules that people can opt into as opposed to have the new rules forced on them?
Now, with the example of Hong Kong, of course, you had, I guess, one central authority, you know, in the form of the British government, keeping order and keeping a guiding hand over the development of the former colony. With the model that you're talking about, though, how difficult would it be to get good coordination within that sort of that polis if there is no central guiding hand, if you're looking for input from various people, from the developing nation, perhaps from developed nations, perhaps from corporations?
Well, if you think about the rules that it takes to build a modern, successful city, one of the critical kinds of rules is a commitment that contracts will be respected. If that rule is enforced in an area, then you can get investors who might come in and make very long-run investments, build out a power system, build the roads, build the port, the airport for a brand new city, help it develop very quickly. But then the question is, how can you get to a place where investors believe that their contracts will be respected, that if they go in and do all of this, that they'll earn the returns that they were planning on instead of having their investments just taken away from them? So bringing in an outside entity like Britain that can play the role of the guarantor of a commitment, say, that the developing country makes, that we will respect contracts out for many decades into the future. Bringing in a guarantor doesn't necessarily mean that you have to have a kind of a big squabble about who's in charge. So think of what the third parties do is bring in the potential for independent, objective enforcement of an agreement that the developing country would like to make with investors who could come in and help it build a new city.
And on Future Tense, our guest is Paul Romer, Senior Fellow at the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research. OK, now, Mr. Romer's only been promoting his Charter Cities concept for a matter of months, but it's already drawn international interest and flak. One of the criticisms is that any developing nation establishing a charter city would risk draining the rest of the country of its existing talent and capital. Paul Romer again.
This is a very real concern, and it's an issue that needs to be examined. I think the net effect would actually be to go the other direction. If you look at many of these very poor countries, the college-educated workers who are trained in these countries very frequently leave and come to the United States, Canada, Europe, Australia. So part of what you could do if you had a modern, well-governed city is attract back the nationals who have left the region. In addition, you could also attract highly skilled individuals from who had been residents or citizens in other parts of the world to come live in an area and start to interact with people close by. So Hong Kong attracted highly skilled people from all over the world. And eventually, when China opened up, the presence of all of that talent in Hong Kong created many more opportunities for trade, for manufacturing, for growth inside China than China would have had if Hong Kong weren't there.
Is this idea, is it a recognition or a statement about our aid efforts into the developing world in previous decades, that they haven't been effective in terms of significantly raising the wealth and the well-being of developing nations?
It's not a critique of aid so much as just a recognition that the total benefit that aid can provide is very limited. We won't solve global poverty through more aid. There just isn't enough aid dollars. There aren't enough aid dollars in the world to lift everyone out of poverty. But there is an alternative mechanism. People around the world, the poor people around the world, are very valuable economic resources. If we free them from rules which hold them back, which let their true productivity not be realized, if we free them from those rules, put them in an environment where the rules let them work with workers from other parts of the world, skilled workers who might move in close proximity to them, investors who might invest nearby. If we unleash their power, we can rapidly raise people out of poverty. And it's the kind of path which has raised a billion people out of poverty in China in a way that aid never has and never will.
Some people listening to this might say, look, this sounds like a good idea, but if it really could work, it would have already worked by now. There'd be more examples than just Hong Kong to give. What would you say to that?
Well, I think that, again, it's a very good insight. It raises a very important question. Why haven't we seen more things like this? This is closely related to the question of why do so many societies get trapped with bad rules? You can look at the rules that they're using to govern their daily lives, and everyone can see that those rules are bad, but it's so hard to change the rules that they stay trapped there. And I think what this is an insight about how very difficult it can be to change rules when you've got a fixed group of people already in place. Because to change rules that apply to everyone, you have to go through a long process of consensus building to try and get many people to buy into the change. And then in the end, there's always some people who resist, so you have to use some coercion to force those people to make a change that they don't want to make. Now, what this charter city idea builds on is the potential for creating brand new places where you start out with a very different set of rules and then you let people opt in. Now, historically, this did happen more often than it has recently. Since World War II, what's happened is that all of the borders in the world have been fixed and there's really no land left where people could create brand new governments with brand new rules. If you think back to the formation of, say, the colonies in the United States, there were several different colonies that were started with different kinds of rules, and they competed with each other. Some of the systems with better rules outcompeted the others and were part of how the system of government in the United States grew up. In today's world, there's no free geography where you could do an experiment like create the United States. What this proposal suggests is that there would still be a way for countries to come together to identify some small bits of land and to use those as the basis for experimentation in the sense of creating brand new rules, brand new places to live. The other thing that makes this possible is that many people, millions of people, can live in a very small bit of territory in a well-governed, well-run city. And in fact, the people get big benefits from living that way. So it doesn't take very much new land freed up in this way to get, I think, some very significant experimentation and benefit for the people who go there.
Now, according to Paul Romer, he's already had conversations with the governments of several developing nations about his Charter Cities concept, specifically about implementing the idea on a small rather than mega scale, establishing special economic zones, for instance, instead of full cities. But inevitably, there's the spectre of colonialism to deal with, and that's something he's all too aware of.
It's a very understandable reaction, and there's a history of all kinds of harm, both material harm, violence, and psychological harm done by relationships between rich countries and poor countries in the past. So there's reasons to be cautious here and to tread carefully. But we shouldn't let that blind us to the potential for doing something that could be genuinely beneficial. And this is one of those points where I go back to this notion of choice. If we think about a young family, a husband and wife with some kids in an area, again, where they have no sanitation, they're threatened with crime, they have congestion, they can't get jobs, and we think about that family wanting to move to Vancouver, is there anything wrong or morally suspect about their desire to move to Vancouver? And should we stop it on some grounds that it's kind of condescending or immoral to have them move to Vancouver? I think no one would say that. But then if we're not going to let millions and millions of people move to Vancouver, which we're clearly not, or Sydney, or pick your city, then turn it around and say, well, what if we could create conditions like Sydney or Vancouver somewhere else in the world and let people move there? Shouldn't we respect their choice, their preference to go to a place like that? Shouldn't we even encourage that? So the big difference about this approach is instead of the coercion that was involved in so much of the colonial enterprise before, things were imposed on people that they didn't want. This is a case where we're creating options for people to adopt new systems, options that they currently don't have.
Paul Romer from Stanford University in California.